This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
On the Breakfast Grill today, Tan Sri Dr. Lin Si Yan, who served as Deputy Bank Negara Governor from 1980 to 1994. He actually spent 34 years as a central banker. He also currently sits on the board of many listed companies and heads his own advisory called Zeta Advisory. If you have any comments, text us at 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Tan Sri, good morning. Today, good morning. We want to get a sense of your sentiment of the country, both as a technocrat and as a Malaysian. We are facing extraordinary times. The Prime Minister recently unveiled the revised budget, and this was to deal with the crashing ringgit, falling oil prices and so on, is a response to tough global conditions. Do you think that this is a reflection of our own lack of preparedness, our own lack of competitiveness, rather than a reaction to global conditions?
Reaction to global conditions is only one of the elements. But I think what surprised many, many of us is the deep depreciation of the ringgit. And I have been looking at this for a while now. One, we don't deserve anything close to $4. Definitely. When I retired from bank,
it should be stronger than $4.
Oh, much stronger. I'm one of those who believe in a strong exchange rate for a variety of reasons. When I retired in 94, the economy is growing at 9% and the ringgit was 241, 42. I mean, sorry. Yeah, 240, yeah.
And of course, the Asian financial crisis happened after that, and it went to almost five.
And there were, again, non-economic reasons for it. Again, if you ask me, we don't deserve 380. Really. Yeah.
You say that there are non-economic reasons for it, but everything falls to the market, right? Because we have subscribed to a kind of free market economy. Yeah. So whatever the case may be, that mantra that the market is always right.
Well, if you compare, if you believe what the central bank says, that the economy is basically strong, right? And if you look at the reaction of international exchange rates to what's happening in the world, the average depreciation is 8 to 10%. We went 30% within 18 months. That's why I say we don't deserve that. So there is something else that propelled that sharp depreciation. In fact, we were one of the worst. We were placed in the same category as Brazil. My God, Brazil, Russia, even Turkey. No way we can come, it should be anywhere close to that. If you believe that the economy is basically strong, maybe 8%, 10%, look at the Thais, look at the Filipinos.
I want to talk about some of these other factors that caused the ringgit to go down worse than it actually deserved. But for now, I think there is a question coming in talking about Malaysia's economic fundamentals. And the question is it as strong as they say, as Zeti and other members of the government say it is? And I want to tie that into this book that you wrote called The Global Economy in Turbulent Times, where you lament that the global economy is broken. And can you tell us what are the factors that led to this brokenness of the global economy?
I think the whole situation was exaggerated in the recent recession, right? The American recession at 2008-09. Yeah. And if you look at that, they tried to get out of the system by monetary policy, by cheap money, And that was a disaster. Simply because all empirical research that I know of shows that if you want to get the best way to get any country out of a recession is fiscal policy, not monetary policy. But fiscal policy was important. Congress just won't act. So everything was was put on the hands of the central bank, and we get what we deserve today. One, interest rates in the world are either negative or zero. Two, if you look at the balance sheets of central banks, they are highly inflated, enormously, and this is going to be a problem. Third, you have the problem of overuse of monetary policy, as a result of which it can no longer function. Finally, of course, the impact of all this is, it has nothing to do with monetary policy, or rather put it the other way around, where monetary policy cannot do anything about, and that is the enormous amount of inequalities of wealth.
Now, the other argument, and it's interesting that you say that there is too much focus on monetary policy, but the other argument is also the fact that some economists propose the idea that the world is too fixated on growth, right? Whether it's through monetary policy, through the actions of central banks, QEs and so on, or through government spending. Right now in the US, they are trying to nominate a president for America, and it's very polarizing. On one end, you have Donald Trump, who's very antagonistic and who's pro corporations, pro growth. He wants to reduce taxes. On the other hand, is Bernie Sanders, who wants to give free tuition and he wants to break up Wall Street. Now, the question I wanted to ask is, does Bernie Sanders have a point? Do we need to think about other things rather than a fiscal or monetary policy that is so fixated on growth?
Let me first think, growth is only a proxy, right? For example, if you look at the Fed Reserve a mandate, it is employment. So growth becomes the proxy for employment. And it is legitimate, right? I mean, what do you want a government for? Create jobs. Unfortunately, the recession led to a jobless recovery.
Have you spent on education and you spend a lot of money for students to go to school, that may not necessarily result in any growth in the short term, right? Because you're spending on things, social programs that may not necessarily be profitable in the short term.
I think I'm a big believer in education. What happens in education is the education system hasn't changed to the real world. For example, the digital, what they call today the fourth industrial revolution of artificial intelligence and the Internet of Everything, right? If you look at the United States, for example, I'm told the latest figures show that close to 500,000 jobs are not filled because you can't put a square peg in a round hole.
And yet they have such deep inequality problems.
Absolutely.
And if we direct this back to Malaysia, which is such a small country in the global scene, is our fate kind of sealed by what is happening globally? Beyond giving government handouts and so on, what can we do to make life better for ourselves?
As structured today, we will never get out of the middle income trap. There's no way we can get out. Part of the reason is we have not reformed the system. There's nothing wrong with the transformation programs which the government has put in place, but they are not implemented. Big part of it is education, right? I think our education system has broken down, although they are trying to fix it now. But even then, I think a simple question of English, for example, right? We can't decide. Today we say, we should promote English. Tomorrow, maybe we should only increase the number of hours for English. And so we are not committed to what I call real reforms. And unless you reform, you're not going to get out. And at the heart of the reform is, which is not just unique to Malaysia, but the entire world, lack of productivity. Look at the United States, right? For 5 years now, there's no increase in productivity. We are having the same problem here. Yeah. So at the heart of, if you want to increase productivity, you need a well-educated labor force. You can't run away from that.
Tan Sri, 1MDB, we're all too familiar with this issue. We've gained international notoriety for this investigations by the Swiss and Singaporean authorities. And many believe that it had played a significant role in the ringgit crash. Now, you've been, of course, Deputy Governor of Bank Negara. Give us an idea of the kind of powers that Bank Negara has to deal with political influence in the banking system. I mean, Zeti did act with boldness, Governor Zeti, to revoke 1MDB's money transfers and to instruct it to repatriate those monies. But those money transfers still happened under the watchful eyes of Bank Negara and in utter disregard of the rules and regulations.
Bank Negara's role is essentially the conduct, the design, implementation and conduct of monetary policy. That's its role, nothing else. On top of that, there is this old exchange control law which the British brought in during the Sterling Era days and which we tried to get rid of, but we decided in the end, instead of getting rid of the exchange control law, we brought down the wall. That means the amount of restrictions, we made them very liberal, but we left the wall where it was so that should we need it, we can always raise the height of the wall.
No, the specific words that were used, at least according to the newspapers, are that Bank Negara revoked permission to invest, right? This seems a little bit draconian. It seems a little bit kind of micromanaging. Under what circumstances does a central bank like Bank Negara can meddle with the investing decisions of the government or private entity?
So under this exchange control rule, which is very liberal, if you remit or invest a large amount of money in which you borrowed, you need Bank Negara approval. There's a very simple rule at Bank Negara. If it is your money, your own money, you can do whatever you want with it, right? But you cannot borrow and take it out. You can if you have a good reason for it, right? So that's where Bank Negara comes in, under exchange control, not monetary policy, exchange control, trying to ensure that the savings, the high savings we have generated in Malaysia, is first used for investment in Malaysia. But they are not a dog in the manger. If there are good reasons to invest abroad, they will allow it. And hence, you need permission. That's where the flouting of the law comes in, yeah.
So do you think that this is where the line is drawn with Bank Negara's role and they have executed that role to the best abilities? Do you think that that role of Bank Negara should be expanded in order to further safeguard the financial resources of the country?
Well, that raises this broad question of exchange capital controls, right? For a small country, I think you need that access to capital controls. You know, we have a saying in central bank that when you are under attack, when your currency is under attack, no amount of currency is big enough. And it's the other way around when you are on the other side. And so you need some form of a protection, at least a circuit breaker, right? I think nobody likes the capital controls. But as I said, if we are an open, free, small economy, the world can do havoc to you, especially with QEs. Tons of money around, they come in good times, and when things doesn't look as good, everything goes out. So your economy is subject to enormous instability, which is not good. Yeah.
We're speaking this morning with Tan Sri Dr. Lin Si Yan, former Bank Negara Deputy Governor. Tan Sri, I just want to speak a little bit about that huge forex loss that happened way back in 1992 when you were still within Bank Negara at that time. Bank Negara and the country lost about a US$5.5 billion. Tell us something about what was going through your mind and what was going through behind the scenes at Bank Negara at that time.
I think this has, it's one of the offshoots of managing your reserves. How active should you be managing your reserves? There's a rule in central banking that you manage it and get a decent return without running very high risk, and certainly not taking an open position on currencies. That's an unwritten rule in central bank. So if you look at most central banks over the years, they are essentially invested in what we call gilt-edged securities, very safe, practically can't-fail type of bonds. But when you begin to extract more from dealing in currencies, especially taking positions, then you have a conflict of interest position because you are a regulator, but at the same time you want to maximize the returns of your reserves. So there's a conflict of interest.
There was a sense that, and $5.5 billion at the time, US dollars, was a huge sum of money. But there was a sense of some kind of political influence to make those trades.
Well, I think I prefer not to comment on the political side, but
which is so important, isn't it? Because we've come today, we have arrived at 1MDB today, and the pervasiveness of politicians.
Oh, the two situations are completely different. When you begin to play with currencies to try to manage your reserves, you can do it with the best of intentions, right? Whether you are competent to do that, whether the law allows you to do that, and whether it is good for the international community for central banks to be involved, these are policy issues, but not moral issues, not ethical issues, not accountability issues.
Now, these words are bandied about quite often, right? Independence of the central bank. What does that mean?
The independence of the central bank only involves monetary policy, nothing else. That is to say, the central bank, when it comes to the running and designing and implementation of monetary policy, it is as independent as it can get, bearing in mind that the central bank has to be accountable to somebody, right? Since the governor neither the governor nor its senior officials are elected officials in the country. So it has, our system of democracy is such that we have to be accountable to somebody. So finally, we are accountable to the Minister of Finance.
Who is the Prime Minister currently? And you've also commented before that this duality of the role of Prime Ministership and the Finance Minister isn't right.
Yeah, it's a conflict of interest again, you see. That's why I just wrote about it in my last comment on Tun Razak, his legacy. And Tun Razak was the first to become both minister. He was extremely uneasy, simply because of that conflict of interest. As you know, this is a simple rule in accounting and financial management. The person who collects the money doesn't spend it. That's a simple rule. And that's why... when it comes to fiscal policy, current transactions, current account, being of salaries, servicing of debt, and things like that, you are stuck with it. You can't do very much. So the Minister of Finance continues to do that. But when it comes to development expenditure, normally the Minister of Finance doesn't have the final say. In our country, it's the EPU, which comes under the Prime Minister. Same with Thailand, and many other countries have the same thing. But when you combine the two, and then you have a problem of conflict of interest. Yeah.
Now, Tan Sri, I want to spend some time talking about the mega merger. There is a sense that this is very much a rigged game, because, at least in my view, because when you want to, when a bank wants to go shopping for another bank, they need Bank Negara's approval. And then as far as pricing is concerned, I think Bank Negara has a very strong degree of influence with that as well. Banking consolidation that happened in the 90s, a lot of bank owners, small bank owners at the time, were very dissatisfied with the pricing that they got with that policy to dwindle, 20 to 30 banks right down to 10 or below. What are your comments on that?
There are various aspects of this. The central bank came in to try to manage consolidation, is to maintain an orderly market, right? You don't want banks to go to the like a fish market, you know? Hey, I have a bank for sale.
But you know the fish markets are very efficient. They know about pricing and they know what they want to buy. Shouldn't the Bank Negara leave it to shareholders to decide what price they want to pay or what price?
Oh, in the end, the shareholders will decide. No question about it. Yeah, all the central banks that try to bring the parties together, and where necessary, put some goodies on the table so that they can come to an agreement. There are two types of banks involved. One, you have situations where a bank owns another bank, right? Don't forget that a lot of the value comes from the license, you know? And the license is given by the central bank.
Was that the right policy, though, to create 10 super banks? And recently, we also saw the mega merger attempt the merger of CIMB, RHB, and MBSB. Is there a role for small banks? And is it a correct policy to create big banks out of a nation?
I believe that big banks and small banks can coexist. What is important is good management. And of course, have to be well capitalized. I'm one of those who believe that if you are very successful in consolidation, you create mega banks that become too big to fail, and more importantly, too big to manage. That's not good. As a result, the small people in particular, small businesses are left out from the credit cycle. And this is happening today. So I believe that the two can coexist, that we need small banks, and small banks, especially community banks, they are more local, they are more sensitive to the needs of the... And why not, if they are well capitalized and well managed? Yeah.
Now, Tan Sri Zetis will end her term as governor in a few months' time. A lot of names have been proposed for it. Do you have a pick?
I won't go into names, but central banking is a unique profession, you know. Lonely profession, because central bank is the only one that does what it does in one country, because there's only one central bank. So they take solace with other central banks. And they are unique in the sense that they are the only organization in the world, central bank, with this power of monetary policy, control of monetary policy. And for that, to do that well, you need a different mindset, different type of training. If you look at the history of Bank Negara, we have had all sorts of governors who are not from the profession. We have the obvious case is, you say, why don't you just appoint a commercial banker? Well, we had two governors that were commercial bankers. In my view, now how do I put it diplomatically? They didn't turn out to be what most people expect. And not surprisingly, because commercial bankers are essentially short-term people, especially those that are listed, right? They are short-term. Whereas Bank Negara always sits on the helicopter and look down, whereas commercial bankers like to micromanage. It's a different profession. So if I have any advice for people who are going to appoint a governor, if you are thinking of a commercial banker, please look at it very, very carefully. Yeah.
Tan Sri, thank you so much for joining us and for your candid views. That was Tan Sri Dato, Dr. Lin Sian, former Bank Negara Deputy Governor as well as President and CEO of his own advisory, Zeta Advisory. You've been listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Julian Ng, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.